to principles of environmental toxicology. Well, just like the students in this class taking a journey through this subdiscipline, this discipline of environmental toxicology, today's lecture, Distribution and Storage of Toxicants, is about journeys. And it's about the journeys that the toxicants and toxins take once they've crossed those primary epithelial cell barriers that we talked about next time. What they do in terms of transport phenomenon is what we're going to try to describe today. We'll try to give some introductory sort of case study examples of what can happen in terms of distribution pathways, but also about storage as being a primary source or resource of intoxication, if our bodies are in fact storing toxins in some fashion or another. And we've already talked about lipophilic toxins that would store in our adipose tissues, our fat tissues. We can also talk about perhaps inorganic toxicants such as lead and vanadium that would store in our bone materials in a very similar pathway to that of calcium and phosphate. Today, our learning objectives, what we'll try to do is have you identify some of the ways that toxicants are distributed in the body. Most of us can feel our pulse, and we have a sensation that, in fact, there is significant fluid flow within our own bodies. We'll talk about those more active flow and also some of the more passive flow dynamics in terms of distribution of toxicants in the body. We'll try to recognize the relationship between the route of absorption and the pathway of distribution. As, for example, there are, as we identified last lecture, there is extremely active and rapid potential for distribution with high blood flow, like in the pulmonary or respiratory systems. We'll try as well today to describe some of the factors affecting distribution. We'll define volume of distribution, not perhaps in this lecture, but in the text. I will warn you that in some editions of the used textbook, the volume of distribution definition is inverse of what it should be. Make sure that the definition that you're reading or the equation you're reading makes practical sense to you in the same way we talk about volume and concentrations in normal concentration units. It's an unfortunate typographical error. We'll try as well today also to list some of the storage sites, this through your reading and also through some of the lecture material. We'll try to discuss how storage influences toxicant half-life. For example, you can imagine that it is a longer half-life for something that gets actively stored, like a lipophilic compound, like PCBs in body fat. All of you, as I have introduced, have a residual store in your body fat of some of the organochlorine pesticides used in the latter part of the last century, because these are still cycling through the ecosystem, a long half-life in the ecosystem and in animal tissues, and also a long half-life in your system. We'll use several case studies. We'll talk and finish out with models of storage and distribution, how these models are actively used in terms of risk management and risk assessment. I will warn you several times during this lecture that there are two pieces of software on the resources module of the course website, and I believe also in this lecture website, regarding some blood lead modeling programs, lead spread and IEUBK. And then also another piece of software, which is a little bit more difficult to download and get working because it's an MS-DOS program, and that's a probit analysis calculator. Probit analysis calculator for ecotox risk assessment. Both of these lead risk assessment software programs and the probit analysis program are going to be required for successful completion of exam one. Okay? These are fairly straightforward pieces of software, although probit is perhaps in a format you're not used to. It is still fairly simple. Get it working prior to the exam. I'd be happy to answer any questions, help you, guide you through, and if you need to, we can take some time either by email, telephone, or by appointment to work it through for you so that you can actually get these programs working for you and have at least a preliminary understanding, especially with regards to IEUBK, of how to input data, come up with a predicted blood lead level in children, and then use that in a risk assessment format. Okay? Handy skills to have, but also necessary skills for our examination. Well, today we're transferring from our previous discussion of absorption to the next step in this pathway of distribution. We found that absorption through the skin, lung, or intestinal tissue is followed by some passage into this interstitial fluid. And the interstitial fluid makes up about 15%. You'll see various numbers of this. Interstitial fluid is the fluid that's not within a cell, for example. Intracellular fluid is about 40% of the total. Blood plasma is about 8% of the total. And again, this varies by gender and by species type in animals, but they're significant in terms of approaching at least double digits in terms of percent flow. We'll look at some other diagrams in the course of the lecture that allow you to break those fluids down as well. What we find is that the toxin is absorbed and it enters through this interstitial fluid, either through the cells or modified through the fluid between the cells. And we can also talk about the fact that our bodies are in a certain sense large balloons, water balloons, if you will. And there's a significant amount of just free fluid in our organs and also in our body, this interstitial fluid. And this interstitial fluid is balanced in part by our vascular system, but also by our lymph system. Swelling injuries sometimes cause an imbalance of this stasis, this osmotic pressure, and also the fluid pressures between high pressure domains like your blood system and low pressure domains like your lymph system in terms of managing fluid throughout your body. Excuse me. These various toxicants can be mobilized because we do have fluid flow in our bodies from one part of the body to other parts of the body. This can aid in elimination because all fluids will eventually be filtered, whether it be in the lymphatic system or in the blood system through the kidney. And this is a primary step in terms of elimination of the toxicants through the body. So this mobilization is typically a good thing in terms of decreasing the toxicant concentration, but at the same time it also can mobilize it to sites of potential injury, and we'll talk about this in a future lecture in terms of target organ toxicity, where in fact this toxicant may have direct action on a particular organ, organelle, or organ system. The toxicant also at the site of injury and also when it's distributed can enter tissue cells and do significant amounts of damage in terms of turning specific mechanisms off, turning them on, or interrupting with a various array of potential toxic endpoints. These toxic endpoints we reviewed earlier in some of our preliminary lectures. In terms of distribution, how we move toxicants from one part of the body to another, we have two major distributions, active distribution systems. The lymphatic system, it's a slower system, slow circulation. Typically what we find in the lymph system is that it is made up of capillaries, nodes, tonsils, your spleen, your thymus, and lymphocytes. It actually drains fluid from various systems around your body. What it does, your lymph capillaries actually are not pressurized. You talk about blood pressure. We have a blood pressure system and therefore a potential for osmotic pressure. In lymph, we don't have a pressurized system. In fact, lymph moves by movement. If you have a swelling injury, sometimes the doctor, after the initial healing, will encourage you to move that limb to drain it. Peristalsis is the muscular movement of some of the fluids associated with lymph, an important part of lymph drainage. The lymph system actually ends in terminal capillaries, so essentially like the fingers of your hand. Each terminal capillary is a membrane that allows for fluid transport from interstitial spaces in between cells and across membranes to drain it, and it allows for transport of toxins if that may be in terms of a concentration gradient across that membrane, as well as transport of various lymph system components up into, for instance, the site of an injury, the site of a infectious disease. Lymph system also helps us mobilize fats, especially we talked talked about the importance of the lymph system in the microvilli and villi in your intestinal lining. It's to deliver antibodies in case of infection, but it also allows for active transport of fats via an emulsification process. And so the milky white nature of some lymph is associated with these emulsified fats. Cardiovascular system, on the other hand, is a very rapid flow. Anyone who has ever seen films or videos of an arterial injury knows that this fluid is under high pressure because of our heart and drains very rapidly from one place to another in terms of blood flow. The cardiovascular system contains the heart, the arterial and venous vessels, capillaries in the blood. There's very rapid circulation, and so direct intravenous dosing of a toxicant, such as an intravenous drug user, allows for a very rapid circulation systemic effects throughout the body. Those pathways, such as respiratory intoxication, where you have very rapid exchange with the pulmonary system for oxygenation of blood, can also allow for very fast intoxication because of the very high transport of that membrane. The major distribution of toxicants is considered to be the blood, although both of these systems are important in the circulation of potential toxicants in the body. The blood system is, again, the major toxicant transport medium. It contains not only the plasma, which is a non-cellular fluid, and so this is the water plus all of the inorganic ions and organic materials, free fatty acids, fats, some proteins, for example, human serum albumin, which is shown here in terms of a ribbon diagram of that particular protein, is actually the major protein in your body. In blood, it's about 30 to 50 grams per liter, okay? Important for maintaining osmotic pressure, important for nutrient transport, and it's also important for binding various toxins in terms of transport and setting it up, hopefully for elimination, but sometimes, as it turns out, it affects systemic distribution to perhaps other target sites within the body. Blood contains erythrocytes. These are red blood cells, important for oxygen transport. Erythrocytes have significant hemoglobin levels. They have a substantial lifetime. They're on the order of months, 60 to 90 days is probably typical. Leukocytes are white blood cells. These are made up of several subcategories. If you ever had a CBC or complete blood panel in a physical, you've seen the breakdown of your leukocytes, neutrophils, basophils. These are immune function. They register, for example, antibody function. They register, for example, allergic reactions to histamine. We'll talk a little bit about that. Platelets, another category of your blood. These cells are cells that are also called thrombocytes, important in terms of clotting mechanisms. These have relatively short lifetimes, on the order of weeks. You'll notice that we talk about sometimes anticoagulants as being toxicants. Anticoagulants, a very popular type of rodenticide, or rat poisons, or mice poisons. These anticoagulants interact directly with the fibrinogen and the clotting action that are important in terms of platelet function. When we have a toxicant that enters the bloodstream, it can affect the body in terms of the location of where it enters. As we've kind of introduced in the digestive system, we have a portal vein. The portal vein rapidly carries toxicants to the liver. It's a major blood flow pathway, a substantial amount of blood. I believe 50 to 60% of your blood flow at rest is the portal vein running through a first pass take. It's called first pass. That's something to asterisk in your notes. where we get digestive results, these monomers, these nutrients, and also potential toxicants that are absorbed either by active or passive membrane transport. They go into the capillaries in the intestinal tract. We saw how these are extremely vascularized tissues with high surface areas. These drain to the portal vein. The portal vein passes to the liver and deposits in the liver and the liver cells, in terms of liver physiology, all of the actual reactants in terms of the metabolic byproducts that the liver makes in terms of the molecules of life. The polymers such as glycogen, polymerization occurs and metabolism occurs in the liver. And as well, it's the primary organ in terms of detoxifying all of those secondary compounds that exist in our normal everyday diet that have potential for toxicosis. In the respiratory system, this is of interest because we have transferred directly into the pulmonary circulation. We also find that not only can chemicals via solubility and membrane transport pass into the pulmonary system, but if we have particulates that are small enough, and typically these are sub-5 micron, sub-2 micron, very, very small particles, can actually pass through the interstitial cell space. The walls in between two cells allow for some passage of these very, very small particles. Again, this is sort of a peristalsis motion. Then at that point in time, it can enter pulmonary circulation, it can enter lymph circulation. As it turns out, the lymph system is pretty good at circulating particulates around and setting them up for elimination. We also find in terms of toxicants that particles that have a shape or a chemical reactivity can actually be a primary toxicant in terms of interacting with lung tissue. An example of this is asbestos. Asbestos is a mineral, but the particle shape is one of that similar to a needle. These needle-like forms, as you can imagine, are hard to essentially pass through tissue. They don't interact well with your mucociliary escalator in terms of once you breathe in these needles, they take up residence. And what we have is a continuous irritation of the tissues around this needle, and that's one of the impacts in terms of the steps to lung cancer from asbestos. We have percutaneous or dermal transport of toxicants. And here, as you have heard in several lectures now, that the toxicant can enter the peripheral blood supply, and then once in the blood supply can have a systemic effect or affect organs significantly far away in the body. Some of the factors that will affect the toxicant's distribution, and we've talked about these, are the physical or chemical properties of the toxicant. Some of these will include its polarity, nonpolar versus polar, how soluble it is in water, how soluble it is in fat. Is it charged? Is it a large molecule? Is it a large molecule with a very small conformation, so conformational in terms of things like protein folding versus other sorts of interactions? Is it reactive? Is it electrophilic? Is it looking for electron sources like nitrogens so that you can have an interaction? These sorts of physical chemical reactivities that you learned about in freshman chemistry and organic chemistry still come to play in terms of the interaction of these chemicals with various chemicals and biochemicals in the body. Concentration gradient plays an important role in terms of determining the volume of distribution. Small doses of moderately or less toxic chemicals can be diluted below any sort of threshold dose for toxicity in terms of the concentration that's required to produce sufficient amount of receptor interaction or tissue damage. When we talk about volume of distribution, and I've said this before, I'll say it again, think of yourself as a big bucket, and this big bucket of water and other stuff will develop a concentration with a fixed dose. And that dose concentration, that volume of distribution, is what is with a useful term to understand in terms of therapeutic monitoring to make sure that you have sufficient dose to have typically a desired effect. But that same volume of distribution will be important to consider in terms of having sufficient dose and dosage to affect some sort of toxic endpoint. Another factor affecting distribution of toxicants is the cardiac output to the specific tissues. Major organs in terms of cardiac output are the liver and kidneys. These organs get significant blood flow, liters per minute, and this blood flow will present toxicants to these organs in very rapid fashion. And so if it is a very reactive toxicant, there is a potential for these organs to sustain some sort of reactive damage and the residual toxic endpoints. We also have to be concerned with the tissue sensitivity of the toxicant. An example of this is adipose tissue is going to, for instance, take up certain types of very nonpolar toxicants just because of chemical selectivity and solubilization in those tissues. The various receptors that we have where we find, for example, certain proteins that bind certain metals when presented with another metal, perhaps a heavy metal with a similar distribution, electronic distribution and charge, might actually, and this is the case with lead and some calcium transport proteins, lead is a significantly heavier, different reactivity. When it does bind with those proteins, it actually binds in a very harsh way and sometimes precipitates those proteins out of your blood, causing at least the initial stages of lead toxicosis. We also need to be concerned in the body about the various barriers that inhibit migration. We've introduced these, and I'll have a slide here later about these barriers, the blood-brain barrier, the placental barrier, the blood-mammary barrier. All of these might be considered evolutionary strategies to kind of keep us in safe and sane, if you will, upon the normal and natural exposure to nature's toxicants and as well as any sort of industrial or synthetic toxicants that may exist in the environment that we live in. Now, in terms of the distribution of toxicants, plasma protein binding, as I've introduced, is important. It's important if for no other reason that we have significant amounts of serum albumin, again, on the order of grams per liter. These toxicants that bind to proteins, this can be somewhat of a good thing in terms of transport. If it's reactive to some of the potential functional groups on this protein, this is a protein that we've got plenty of in terms of the concentration, and it can detoxify just because of this binding, get it out of solution, get it away from more sensitive cells, more sensitive receptor sites, sensitive tissues. And so in a certain sense, this is a the pawns, if you will, in the chess game of toxicology. These proteins are out there, they're in high concentration, easily metabolized, and easily eliminated. This binding can affect distribution. It can also affect the toxicant half-life in the organism. The free toxicant is going to be in some sort of equilibrium with the bound, and it can be available for some sort of distribution and endpoint effect. Whenever you have binding, thermodynamics is dictating a stability profile of what remains in solution, and hopefully the amount that is bound to the protein is sufficient to allow for a non-threshold effect. I'm sorry, not a non-threshold, a below threshold or no observed effect level in terms of the concentration in the plasma. A plasma concentration is a good indicator of toxicant concentration at the site of action. you have to remember that in toxicology, you know, quite often we're dealing with live patients, whether it be animals or humans. And we can't necessarily do extraordinarily invasive analyses. We do some in animal models and testing. For example, we'll radio label certain chemical compounds and look for the distribution. We can do this in organs via radiography, look for various organelles where these toxicants might accumulate and therefore have some sort of effect. And we can look at the morphological and endpoint effects with destructive tissue monitoring and sacrifice of the animal. We don't do this now in humans. We do it occasionally with autopsies of individuals that have succumbed from various poisonings. But typically what we find is that plasma concentration is the indicator. So for example, next time you do take a medicine, a drug, again, pull the physician desk reference insert. You will see indications of plasma concentrations, therapeutic concentrations in various scenarios of dosage, and perhaps some warnings in terms of overdosing or underdosing, especially, for example, with antibiotics. We talked about the apparent volume of distribution, V sub D, and that's the total volume of body fluids in which the toxicant is distributed. And so the V sub D, the volume is going to be smaller for smaller people. So what does that mean in terms of an equivalent dose to a small person and a large person? It means that the plasma concentration is going to be smaller for the larger person. Pharmaceutical manufacturers have some concern about the size of the individuals, for example, children's doses or even adult doses for smaller women or larger men, for example, and as well for their various types of chemicals, especially ones that might have some lipophilicity, your body mass index, your BMI, and maybe many of us know what that means, but it's essentially, it's an indicator of your muscle mass to your fat mass. We want that number to be lower than, I believe, 28. For many of us, we achieve that. For many of us, it's a struggle. But this is because we vary in terms of our bodily makeups, this varies the potential dosage of an individual and how that plasma concentration for good therapeutics is achieved. This diagram from a medical textbook, a medical physiology textbook, gives you an idea of the numeric breakdown. And again, this is an estimate of where the body fluid components are. Again, I told you we're a big bucket, but we're actually a fairly complex bucket when you consider the fact that we have bone, dense connective tissues, we have transcellular water, and this is the water that's in the big bags that we call organs. We have cell water, this water that is actually inside individual cells, such as red blood cells. But this gives you kind of an estimate breakdown of where all that water occurs. These sorts of diagrams are useful in physiology. They're compartment diagrams, and so you see nice boxes with arrows. We use similar sorts of approaches when we talk about environmental models. For example, a pond to the atmosphere, we can draw a box indicating the pond and some arrows crossing it into the atmosphere, for example, of escape of volatile components. What we find in terms of total body water, that in men it's about 55% to 60% of the body weight in adult males, and in adult females a little bit less, about 50% to 55% on average. In terms of overall body fat, women have a few percent more, sometimes as much as 10% or 15% more because of just different genetics and different body composition. We are concerned with hepatic treatment of toxicants, so distribution to and from the liver is important. As I've introduced, the portal vein allows this first pass digestive route, and so we get tremendous potential exposure of these exogenous compounds, potential toxicants, typically in low dose, but sometimes in an intoxicating dose. And so because of this and our survival, because we have high exchange nutrient uptake, and this is again the survival of the organism, the portal vein, which drains the gastrointestinal tract, takes those resources directly to the liver for metabolic output. This high cardiac output ensures a major potential for toxicant interaction and then for systemic exposure, because we have such a high transport phenomenon occurring in terms of GIT to the liver. As I've indicated, we do have also the potential for enterohepatic recirculation. I've got a flash animation that we constructed to show you a little bit of how this happens. Obviously, those toxicants that are not well processed by the liver but are eliminated through the bile ducts in the liver back into the intestinal tract have the ability to be reabsorbed, uptake by the portal vein, reintroduced to the liver, and start this recirculation. What does this do in terms of the endpoint? It has the potential for increasing the half-life, because you're not eliminating, you're just recirculating this. This can also happen with liver metabolites that are actually also eliminated through the bile duct system. And this has a lot, quite often with fairly nonpolar metabolites that are actually emulsified with the bile acids. And again, they are discharged in with the bile acids into the gastrointestinal tract. So we find that we have this potential recirculation of blood from the digestive tract to the liver, to the bile ducts, back to the intestine, back to the portal vein, back to the blood. And so this cycling repeat. And again, on the website, I have a flash animation that might help you kind of visually understand that particular recirculation. What I've done here, and again, this is not an anatomy and physiology class. Most of us have seen at least a piece of liver in the supermarket. I encourage you, if you don't have this sort of biology background, to go spend a few bucks and buy a piece of liver from the supermarket. Not necessarily to eat, because most toxicologists don't eat liver, and we don't eat liver because this is the primary waste treatment organ of the body, and we don't eat kidney either. But I invite you to take and do a kitchen top dissection, and it's very similar to what we did in the laboratory here. We retrieved a full liver, multi-lobe liver from a cow, a bovine species. Just to give you an idea, this is a very large, it takes two arms to carry this significantly sized organ. It's a very large animal. What you can see here on this figure is the gallbladder. The gallbladder is a storage bladder for the bile as it's produced from the liver. What this gallbladder allows us to do is store bile so that when we eat, especially a fatty meal, we have a reserve of bile to assist in emulsifying that fat. Those of you that have a friend, loved one, relative, or someone that you know that has had their gallbladder removed, know that these individuals have to be careful about the amount of fat they eat in the diet at one time. They will get some indigestion because the fat remains somewhat undigested. It gets eliminated back into the gastrointestinal tract, and there's a lot of bacterial action, uncomfortable gas, and so this is a situation for those individuals that have their gallbladder removed, typically because of calcifications or gallstones that occur from the bile acids in the liver and passing and residing in the gallbladder. In terms of the hepatic fine structure, when you do your kitchen top autopsy, this is maybe a 5 or 10x magnification. You can see a lot of this structure with your naked eye. Use a sharp knife, and what you'll see is various things like bile ducts, various venous structures in terms of blood flow. This is a highly vascularized organ. You'll see the liver lobules, this fine structure here, these little darkened circles. In target organ toxicology, we'll go in on the cellular basis in terms of describing what these subunits are. But each one of these little lobules in here are actually replicated subunits, liver hepatocytes, that actually are little factories in terms of metabolizing the chemicals that we are exposed to in our diets and respiratory and dermal uptake in terms of systemic impacts through blood flow. I'll also tell you that when we are examining models of intoxication and potential for metabolism, since the liver is the primary organ for metabolism, many of the chemical biotransformations, which is the title of the next lecture, will occur in the liver. And so to model this in an in vitro experiment, in other words, in a test tube or typically in a petri dish as opposed to in a living animal, in a laboratory study where we take isolated hepatocytes, and typically rat hepatocytes, we grow them up in cell culture and we introduce a toxicant, we can watch those cells metabolize those toxicants, and so we can look at the different chemical conformations from these isolated rat hepatocytes. We can model distribution with an engineering diagram, and so those of you who come from more of an engineering or a computer background will find these sorts of diagrams useful in terms of understanding. But in terms of our toxicant coming into an organism, we have the potential for multiple pathways. We can have direct interactions in terms of leading up to some sort of interaction with a cell or excretion. We can have it go off and be shunted to storage, especially for lipophilic or those types of chemicals that store quite easily. They can be biotransformed, typically the liver or the kidney is important in this particular process. These might form metabolites, and we'll talk about how these metabolites are formed, the primary pathways, phase one and phase two. But for example, and I've indicated that urinary excretion is a primary elimination route for detoxification. What do we need in terms of urinary elimination? We need something to be pretty reasonably water soluble. And so if you look at the basic endpoint of metabolism, we want to turn greasy molecules into salty molecules. Greasy molecules are not particularly water soluble, salty molecules are. So we'll talk about that next time in biotransformation. But this diagram gives you an idea of the multiple pathways, and I think it's important to recognize that our bodies have potential for multiple pathways simultaneously. And so you might find in a particular toxin that there will be 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 or more metabolites or pathways that are occurring simultaneously. So it's fairly complex. Sometimes it's extremely simple, but more than likely it's of the more complex variety. Now I'll switch over to storage, and this is an accumulation of toxicants in specific tissues. We've introduced the binding of toxicants to plasma proteins. As I said, albumin is most abundant. That's a common binder of toxicants to transport and detoxification. We can have storage in bones. Typically, these are heavy metals, strontium, oligonuclide, will store in bones. We worry about strontium from whether it's nuclear power or fallout from the nuclear testing in the 50s and 60s as being kind of potential uptake into bones, into food products like milk, cow's milk. And so, for example, in the post-Chernobyl days, the plume of radioactivity dropped over some Scandinavian countries, Finland and Sweden being two of them, where there was great concern about the dairy industry there and preservation of a safe and nutritious dairy food supply. We can have storage in the liver. There's high degree of blood flow. There's significant amount of fat in the liver. Some medical scenarios and intoxication, such as alcoholism, will cause even more fat to accumulate in the liver. It's also a biotransformation organ. So we can actually have misprints or misbiotransformations that will transform it into something that does a little bit more damage, and sometimes that damage is in the kidney itself. We can have storage in the kidneys, we can have storage in our adipose tissue, and this is again primarily lipophilic compounds. I'm going to do a couple of case studies here just to illustrate some of the storage and the release of this. As you can imagine, if we do have storage, that might be a part of our survival strategy to sequester these away from active metabolism and then perhaps bleed this toxicant out at a very, very slow rate, a very low concentration half-life over a long period of time. Again, the idea there is to limit the exposure of critical tissues in terms of reactive endpoints to some toxicants. This was a case I was involved in Petaluma, California. It's a town in Northern California area. Tremendous amount of poultry production for California, not only for fryers in terms of the chicken that you eat, but also for egg production. Those of you have probably understand that there are various ways to do egg production, but one of them is a very high density operation such as these. This one in this particular photograph where we have several chickens in a cage. Typically what we find in terms of managing these in production agriculture is these birds are cycling through estrus, and the producers try to get all of the different chickens in the same estrus cycle. And so what they do is they force the molt that is associated with the avian species. They force a molt typically by changing the light so it seems as if a season is changing. So they'll shutter some of these hen houses. They can change the water or accessibility to water or food. Typically these large-scale environmental changes will induce these molts. During the molt, it's a fairly ugly process. It's perhaps an annual rebirthing of this particular species. They lose feathers. They can lose a tremendous amount of body mass. It's a fairly large-scale physical change in this particular species. As it turns out, with chickens, and especially modern varieties of egg-laying chickens, we find that they are extremely good egg producers. They're bred for their productivity. They lay a lot of eggs, and it's typical of this particular species. As it turns out, chickens have a breastbone. Many of you that have ever had a whole chicken or even a turkey at Thanksgiving know that there's a substantial breastbone in these animals. That breastbone is actually used as a calcium resource in terms of egg laying. There's a tremendous amount of calcium that is shuttled into the egg itself, and so animals that are in production have to be fed calcium supplements. And this is typically as calcium carbonate or as oyster shell, for example. If you've ever had chickens, you know that you have to have one of these out in terms of the chickens will actually feed on these mineral materials because they crave the calcium because of calcium turnover in their own bodies. And so chickens in normal egg laying cycle about 50% of their bone mass in normal egg production. And so the storage and then release of whatever might be stored in the bone material is very, very active. In this particular case, this was a molt gone wrong. There was a 20% death rate. It was an uncontrolled molt. They actually lost tremendous amounts of their bone calcium. It was about a 20% death rate, and in a large-scale chicken operation, this can be hundreds if not thousands of chickens that succumbed. Give you an idea, they lost so much body calcium that their bones became extremely flaccid and brittle. I can tell you that they would break easier than a pencil. You can see in this photo a chicken that actually is sliding out of the egg slot at the bottom. of the particular egg bin in this particular case. What we found in terms of the death rate, losing bone mass in and of itself is not necessarily lethal. What we found was that these chickens may have succumbed to heavy metal toxicosis because of the accumulated heavy metals at low dose that accumulated in their body calcium stores. The oyster shell, the mineral calcium phosphates and calcium carbonates that they are fed do have trace amounts of heavy metal, normal natural heavy metals that occur in these minerals. They can accumulate in bone mass. When it is shuttled out in very high concentration, it can shut down various protein blood transport processes. We found significant levels of lead and vanadium substituting for phosphorus. Vanadium as vanadiol can actually interrupt calcium transport. Calcium transport is required for cell energy cycling, can actually affect a neuromuscular paralysis. Another case study in a very similar situation, different causative factors, but similar in terms of the overall endpoint of lead poisoning. This came from the mobilization of bone stores during a thyrotoxicosis episode. This came out of the American Journal of Industrial Medicine. The case describes a 37-year-old female smoker with a history of childhood lead exposure. This exposure included pica, which is childhood dirt eating. You may or may not have heard of this particular phenomenon of children that just eat dirt. They have found that this has a lot to do with mineral metabolism. And there's also some behavior aspects to it. This individual is also a paint chip eater, and again, this has a lot to do with poverty and lack of nutrition, lack of calcium in the diet. Kids, for whatever reason, and infants even, will find that some of the old paints in old houses will have calcium, and they'll develop a habit of eating paint chips. This individual also had some lead exposure as an adult. Like many of us that have tried to rehabilitate old houses, there is a potential for exposure to lead paint in old houses. This individual presented to her doctor with insomnia, weight loss, muscle ache, and a tremor. On examination, they found that she had high blood lead levels, 51 micrograms per deciliter. Microgram per deciliter is a blood concentration. A deciliter is 1/10 of a liter. You'll see this unit in many clinical diagnostic concentrations. The erythrocyte protoporphyrin EP levels were elevated as well, and this is an indicator of lead toxicosis. This individual also had an enlarged thyroid. Did a bone scan. The bone scan by X-ray analysis revealed that she had 154 parts per million in one bone and 253 parts per million in another. The normal concentration is down around 5 or 10 micrograms per gram. So this is a pretty significant concentration in her bones. As it also was demonstrated on clinical workup, this individual had hyperthyroidism, and that was indicated by her blood workup and thyroid levels. Your thyroid gland are just below your Adam's apple. They consist of your thyroid and your parathyroid glands, and this is a primary metabolic calcium regulating gland as well. This individual underwent radioactive iodine testing to look at the thyroid and the parathyroid. You can see the bright blips here on the particular scan associated with this type of test. Radioactive iodine uptake uses radioactive but short half-life iodine. This individual demonstrated thyroid levels and enlarged thyroid consistent with Graves' disease, a dysfunctional thyroid. Her serum osteocalcium levels, this is a bone protein was elevated, and this indicated increased bone turnover, and so she was hypermetabolizing her bone calcium. They actually treated this individual with what's referred to as thyroid ablation therapy, essentially trying to destroy her thyroid because it is overactive. These individuals would then go on medications, thyroid medications like thyroxin, that they take daily to manage their thyroid hormone levels. Half a year later, this individual had significantly reduced blood lead levels. It was down to 19 micrograms per deciliter, and the osteocalcin levels were normal. So this indicated that they actually were successful in reversing the thyroid-driven metabolism of lead from the individual's bones. The bone stores were unchanged, as you can imagine. This is a lifetime accumulation, but at least it's sequestered and stored away where it can't necessarily do a lot of damage. A year later, the blood lead levels for this individual were at 17. Still high. The blood lead levels in terms of early childhood levels of maximum or levels of action are 10 micrograms per deciliter, and we'll talk about childhood lead poisoning. But this is a very interesting case study in that a medical condition, in this case this Graves' disease, led to the release of the bone stores of lead during this particular medical episode. The routes of exposure that we are dealing with in terms of distribution and storage of toxicants. Remember that the GI tract exposure sends the toxicants directly to the liver for that first pass detoxification. We also have the potential release of toxicants from the digestive system into the lymph system. Respiratory skin exposure can have greater systemic effects. Why might that be? It might be because the fact that it takes a little bit longer to get to that primary detoxification organ. So it has to go throughout a significant amount of pathway through other organs prior to its actual sequestration or potential metabolism in the liver. The rate of metabolism of a particular compound, and this is thermodynamics and biochemistry, that obviously can impact systemic effects. Some slow metabolisms for example, next time you do take a pharmaceutical, the dosage schedule will indicate the metabolic rate of that particular chemical compound. If you have to take it three times a day, it means that it is metabolized relatively fast, and so to keep your plasma concentration up, you need to keep taking this because your system is doing a good job metabolizing it, getting rid of it. If you get rid of something that is a therapeutic medicine, it's not doing its therapy, and so you'll take it more often. There are other medications that you might take once a day, and those will be typically ones that are metabolized a bit slower, and they allow for a volume of distribution and plasma concentration sufficient for a therapeutic end effect. In terms of disposition, these are chemical reactions, and if you remember from freshman chemistry, we introduced to you rates of chemical reactions, and so we can think of the disposition of chemicals as rates of chemical reactions, rates of crossing of membranes from one compartment to another, one box to another, for example, from the interstitial fluid at the site of an injury or dermal uptake across, for example, into the vascular system, into another compartment, maybe referred to as the liver. All of these can be put together in a disposition model. We can break these compartments up as, for example, blood, fat, bone, liver, kidneys, brain. We can take a look at modeling the relationship, and we do these sometimes with animal studies, looking at the appearance and disappearance of chemicals in different organs and different compartments over time, and that's critical. When we do this analysis, we can graph, as we have here, on the x-axis time and the log of the concentration. We do log concentration because that is good for the primary, the dominant kinetics, which is first order kinetics that we observe in metabolism. And so this particular graph would be a one-compartment open model. So we're just looking, for instance, at the disappearance of a contaminant, of a toxicant in blood plasma, for example. But if we start opening up more compartments, and for example, two compartments, it enters the blood and it goes to another compartment, for example, the liver. These disposition models become a little bit more complex. And as you can imagine, when we do things like IEUBK, or the integrated uptake biokinetic model for blood lead, and we'll introduce here in a moment, that we can get very complex very rapidly, and it requires a tremendous amount of input and analysis to get an idea of where everything is going, the different compartments, the different rates of transport and metabolism across these different compartments. So the idea here is that we have a toxicant in this particular model. It enters the blood and it goes to the liver, and then it is excreted or returned. What we find is that overall that we have the blood coming down in time, but the concentration in the liver is going up over time. Both of these decreasing over time because of half-life and elimination and metabolism. But again, the idea is that we're trying to model fairly complex phenomenon. Pharmacokinetics is important. It's important in drug design, but it's also important in understanding toxicology and the rate of impact. There are many intoxications that you may have experienced yourself that take some time. If you have ever suffered from high dose exposure to alcohol because you have you drink alcohol, you notice that there is a time to metabolism. Typically, that's on the order of hours. In terms of your blood alcohol levels, there are advisories in terms of when it is safe to drive, in terms of impaired driving ability due to concentrations. And typically, this is a significant amount of time with overconsumption of alcohol. Another case study here, and this is another heavy metal. This is copper disposition in the ovine species or sheep. In this particular case, these sheep are exposed to a copper sulfate feed supplement at high concentrations. Sheep are actually fairly sensitive to copper. It's a strong oxidizing agent, and there may be may lead to an acute hemolytic crisis from this oxidation pathway. In target organ toxicology, we'll talk about oxidative stress and how these potential oxidative pathways can yield things like acute hemolytic crisis. Hemolytic crisis means that the red blood cells are lysed, releasing hemoglobin into the blood itself. Icterus is a medical term for jaundice because you start actually also breaking down the cells in the liver, releasing bile substrates into the blood as well. Hemoglobin urea, in terms of hemoglobin in the blood itself. Hemoglobinemia, in terms of hemoglobin in the blood supply outside of the red blood cells. Tubular nephrosis meaning death to a particular type of cell in the kidney, and we'll define that in target organ toxicology and nephrotoxicity. In terms of this particular disposition, you can see in this, you can see the jaundice and hemoglobinemia in this particular animal in terms of its soft tissues being discolored. It lyses these erythrocytes, it frees hemoglobin, and causes what's commonly referred to in medicine as a hemolytic crisis. Hemoglobin is toxic to kidney parenchymal cells. Parenchymal cells are the cells that in any organ that do actually do the function. So if you think of the water balloon model of a kidney or your liver, those cells that are inside that are actually doing the organismal work are these particular types of parenchymal cells. They lead to kidney pathology, the production of a darkened kidney, referred to as gunmetal kidney, and subsequent death. This is what gunmetal kidney looks like, and again, in your home kitchen dissection of the kidney. You can do this with a chicken kidney. You can do it with a bovine or cow kidney obtained from your meat vendor. You can see the substructure, and let me tell you that, as you can imagine, a kidney does not look like this inside. It is typically pink and white fleshy material. We'll talk about kidney substructure and filtration mechanisms in our target organ toxicology lecture, but you can just tell just from a morphological and color analysis of this particular disposition that this is not good in terms of kidney function, which is extraordinarily important in terms of maintaining health. Now, we've introduced at several points in the course thus far the various structural barriers that are important in terms of transport of toxicants from one compartment to another. The most important of these is the blood-brain barrier. And in this particular barrier, the brain has these specialized cells called astrocytes, and I've shown a graphic of what they look like. They function in that they limit passage of water-soluble molecules from the capillary endothelium into the actual brain material, the neuron space of the brain. The way they do this is quite easy, and the way all of these barriers work is that these astrocytes have high lipid content, and so they present a lipid barrier. And so, for example, if you are doing drug design, you are going to worry about perhaps making sure that your compound is lipophilic enough that it would pass the blood-brain barrier if, in fact, the therapeutic target was in the brain. In the placenta barrier, we have several layers of structural barrier cells between the maternal and fetal circulatory vessels in the placenta, the same sort of thing. This helps minimize the potential exposure of the developing conceptus from the dietary exposure of toxicants from the mother. We also have another barrier that we've introduced, and that is the blood mammary barrier, same sort of thing. This is for secondary exposure. Not all of this, but again, the same sort of thing in terms of high lipid content cells providing a stopping or slowing down of certain types of chemical compounds. This is another case study. This is our first introduction of lipophilic toxicants. Most of us have heard of PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyl compounds. Perhaps not many of us have heard of PBBs or polybrominated biphenyls. As it turns out, PBBs, and I've given a generic chemical structure here, this is the biphenyl, the two benzene rings linked here, the general biphenyl group. Polybrominated means that at any point on the periphery here, we can have bromines in the same way that for PCBs, we would have chlorines out here. You can see that, in fact, PCBs, and the reason that they're called biphenyls is because there's a multitude of compounds, so it's PCBs and PBBs. Because there are various moieties, and we'll talk about this in our dioxins and related compounds special topic lecture, but this is a category of compounds, and typically there are multiple different levels of bromination or chlorination in a particular environmental sample. These particular chemicals were man-made chemicals back in the 70s, were used as a fire retardant in plastics and in a variety of consumer products. We didn't know as much as we know now about their persistence, bioaccumulation, and toxicity in the environment. It's a relatively stable substance. It does get biodegraded to a degree, but that's a very slow process and very similar to PCBs. It's insoluble in water, but highly soluble in fat tissues. We discontinued manufacturing of PBBs in the United States in 1976. This particular case study came from the Critical Views in Toxicology in 1985 paper. This was a pretty big incident. This appeared on the nightly news. What happened was that in 1973, the year I graduated from high school, by the way, What happened was a chemical manufacturer that sold a product called Firemaster, these PBBs, and they also sold another compound called magnesium oxide, which was Nutrimaster. It was a feed supplement. In the factory, there was a mislabeling event associated with the bags these products went in, and some bags that actually contained PBBs, polybrominated biphenyls, actually went out labeled as this Nutrimaster feed supplement. Worst case scenario, if there ever was one, there were about 10 to 20, 50-pound bags of this material. In feed plant operations, typically these nutrients are blended in with feed. These feed shops then distribute the final product feed to various animal livestock operations, in this particular case dairy and cattle operations, but other ones as well. It was not recognized until long after. This particular chemical is not an acute toxin. It's something that develops over time. It does have the same presentation. We introduced the president of Russia and his chloracne. It takes a little bit of time for it to develop these clinical signs and symptoms. It's typically not an acute toxin. Very sharp veterinarians that were involved were examining these animals and came up with a good clinical diagnosis of what it might be, and in fact the chemical analysis proved what in fact it was. What the problem was is that it had now entered the human food chain. By the time the mix-up was discovered in 1974, this polybrominated biphenyls had entered the human food chain through milk and other dairy products, various beef products, and contaminated swine, sheep, chicken, and eggs. And so this is a highly productive agricultural area, and there was a tremendous distribution of this. There were about 500 Michigan farms that were quarantined, having been purchased feed materials from these particular vendors. The Michigan Farm Bureau was involved. There was approximately 30,000 cattle, 4,500 swine, 1,500 sheep, and 1.5 million chickens that had to be destroyed. There was about 800 tons of animal feed, 18,000 pounds of cheese, 2,500 pounds of butter, 5 million eggs, 34,000 pounds of dried milk products. Typically we would incinerate or bury these materials. This particular photo shows a burial plot probably for the animal carcasses. I can't read the script on it either. I do know it's from the PCB Michigan incident. Now the worry there was, because this has entered the human food chain, obviously there was animal impacts and animal effects in terms of animal health and mortality. The bigger problem was what effect this had on the thousands, if not tens of thousands, of humans that had been exposed to this, and particularly ones in the local environment that might have had local high exposure, as opposed to those that might be out in the greater distributed food system. Some of the residents in the local environment complained of nausea, abdominal pain, loss of appetite, joint pain, fatigue, and weakness. It was very hard to do cause-effect on some of the clinical signs and symptoms. When we think we have been poisoned, we can develop all sorts of problems. It's a very disturbing kind of psychological trauma, if nothing else. And we've seen that in history and in recent history as well. There was some stronger evidence in terms of cause-effect that these PBBs caused some skin problems, the chloracne that's typically associated with these kind of chlorinated or halogenated hydrocarbons. Some workers exposed to PBs by breathing and skin contact also developed acne, even though they didn't necessarily eat the food. This is a little bit hard to see. This is pulled out of Environmental Health Perspectives analysis. This is determinants of PBB serum decay among women in this Michigan PBB cohort. They are still analyzing this, basically because of the long half-life of this. This is a modeling estimate of the half-life in years of serum PBB in women in various scenarios. This is the column with the initial serum polybrominated biphenyl in parts per billion. It's 2 and 5, 2 and 5. And this is the bottom body mass index. And so for relatively low BMI women, less than 23, we find that versus a higher BMI, or higher body fat, greater than 23 body mass index, that the decay rate increases, the decay rate changes, but the half-life is what's significant. For the low concentration, the low BMI women, relatively shorter half-lives, 4 years, 8 years for twice the concentration. For the high BMI women, 5 or 6 years, 22 years. And so significant changes in half-life in terms of the concentration effects, the storage and distribution release of this particular lipophilic compound over time. What we find in terms of retrospective analysis, and this is retrospective epidemiologic analysis of the various individuals that were known to have PBB concentrations and been exposed, there are increased rates of neurologic, immunologic, and dermatologic musculoskeletal effects in this particular analysis cohort. None of the effects showed a consistent dose-response relationship with serum PBB levels, so this is a little bit of a confounding data. And this probably is more reflective of the genetic variability of the cohort, gender variability, dose variability, overall health variability, and dietary variability in terms of those who eat certain types of food in higher concentrations. There were numerous negative correlation study results as well. They did find that the spontaneous abortion rates were elevated in second-generation women that were born after and to moms that were exposed in that polybrominated biphenyl incident. This brings up the case, and we've seen the modeling in that particular retrospective analysis in terms of half-life of the use of models in risk assessment. And sometimes the biggest challenge in developing a model for risk assessment is coming up with an idea of the modeling the complexity of the organism in terms of all the different compartments, the transport dynamics across membranes from one compartment to another. What we try to do is to simplify this complexity. It's an approach to understanding this exposure linkage to human disease, and we do this for typically a risk assessment process. We model in anticipation of potential risk so we know what risk level is acceptable, okay? Zero risk is not only expensive, but it's near impossible. So if we have to have an acceptable risk, where do we strike that balance between risk and benefit in terms of where we put our national efforts, our treasure, in terms of the complex natural environment and also the man-made environment in terms of synthetic toxins? These models are a proxy for situational specific clinical data. Okay, so when we're looking at blood lead in children, we're not going out and dosing children with lead. We actually are modeling this in the best model that we have. We can do these very sophisticated models for toxicants that we have a significant amount of information about. And so this is rare, actually. If you consider the hundreds, if not thousands, of common toxicants, it is rare that we have enough physiological data, enough knowledge about metabolic cycles, interactions, toxic endpoints, all of the different interfaces in an organism. These approaches, in terms of modeling all of these different relationships, are called physiologically based pharmacokinetic models. Okay, and they are the best that we can do. We can get rates of transfer in between, for example, blood and liver. We can program these into these various models and take these exercises and use them in risk assessment. In terms of predicting blood lead levels, blood lead has been a problem for well over a century. We'll talk about that in some of our case studies here. The integrated exposure uptake biokinetic model for lead in children is the most famous of these. It actually was explored and validated or revalidated in a National Academy study just about a year ago. In fact, they used some of the blood lead data from North Idaho and the Bunker Hill, a case study that we will talk about in this course, to validate that particular model. The model software is downloadable. It's a Windows-based module. It's fairly straightforward for students at this level of their studies. I give you the URL in there. Go ahead. The model itself is downloadable for the computer of your choice, as well the basic instructions. I don't want you to think that you need to be an expert in the operation of IEUBK, but you need to know some of its capabilities, how some of the inputs can be varied, and typically I will instruct you in current terms of your exam to leave all of the settings as default and ask you to change or indicate that you might want to change a few of the exposure variables to see how that might affect your risk assessment. Another one that's also useful, and I am not going to detail whether or not you have to use one or the other on your risk analysis. This one's a little bit easier in that it's a spreadsheet-driven macro set called Lead Spread. It's from the California EPA, and Lead Spread is also downloadable. It's a little bit better in terms of diversity of food and food exposure, coming up with very similar and correlated values to IEUBK as a model. The IEUBK model, I'll use a couple of slides here just to give you some background on how we developed this model and how we get it actually working for what we needed it to do. It does attempt to predict blood lead levels for children, and these are children that are exposed to lead in their environment. It allows users to input various relevant absorption parameters. Most users will actually leave the defaults because many of the defaults are from the peer-reviewed scientific literature. For example, the fraction of lead absorbed from water that has been established in the literature is not anything that you might want to change unless you are a researcher looking at variable absorption rates. The inputs from using the inputs that you put into IEUBK, the model will calculate and recalculate various equations that allow you to estimate the potential for blood lead levels that at particular age or age groups in children. And so we can look at, and this is all done by dietary exposure, and the dietary patterns, the intake of water on a age basis, on a weight basis, appropriate with average weights for years. You can do it in segments of months or years of a particular cohort of children. It's a very useful analysis. And given the fact that there has been a tremendous amount of lead medical data that has appeared in the last decade or so that suggests, among other things, there may be no safe level for lead exposure, that it is important that we have a good understanding of a predictability of environmental lead to blood lead levels in children such that we can minimize the potential impact at a very critical stage of these kids' physical and mental development. This measured blood concentration is not only an indicator of exposure, but it's widely used as an indicator to look at future health problems. For example, we have data now that shows blood lead concentrations directly correlate with things like learning ability and IQ, as well as some behavior problems. Childhood blood lead concentrations that are above 10 micrograms per deciliter of blood presents a risk to children's health. There is a move on and a consideration right now to move that down to 10, from 10 to either 5 or 2. Some of the problems that exist with that is just the what would happen, for example, from a CDC point of view, if you found a cluster of children with blood lead greater than 2 or 5 levels. They aren't real clear on what they can do in terms of mitigating exposure at these very, very low levels. In IEUBK, there's an exposure component as you pull up the software, and it compares blood lead concentrations in various food and environmental media. So there'll be a water input, there'll be a food input. This is where it might be very site-specific. There's an exposure component that looks at environmental media and specific concentration rates, and we'll talk about this in terms of lead exposure. But we do find that in children, in their hand-to-mouth activity, and those of you that have children or have been around children, maybe for those of you who've been children once yourselves, you know that there's a lot of hand-to-mouth activity with children. They crawl, toddlers will crawl on the floor. They're down there with the dust bunnies. And lead in dust is a primary exposure vector for children and an indicator of blood lead levels in children. There's an uptake component that allows lead uptake to be from the lungs or digestive tract and absorbed into the blood. There's a biokinetic component to this particular model that allows for transfer between various blood and body tissues, and it also looks at elimination pathways and half-lives and rates of elimination. There's a probability distribution component, and models are all about probabilities of certain outcomes. And so this model allows you to actually input data and come up with a probability of a certain outcome. For example, a blood lead concentration greater than some limit that you might set, which in most cases is a regulatory action level, such as 10 micrograms of lead per deciliter. And use that fraction or that distribution of a population as an action criteria. What we find is that it standardizes, this model standardizes exposure by assuming that the age-weighted parameters, the intake of food or across this particular population that you're studying. It simulates continual growth of the individuals over the period that you're analyzing on a year-to-year basis. So that's a complexity that, in fact, your population, it's not a spot analysis. It looks at their dietary exposure. For example, if it's going to be in dust as being the primary vector of exposure, that dust and the pathway, for example, as the child grows older, there would be less hand-to-mouth and less potential exposure. What we'd find is that the IUBK models intended to estimate a child's long-term exposure to lead and allow mostly around household lead exposure. This is an occupational lead exposure model. It provides an accurate assessment for the geometric average of lead concentration for a typical child in the age range of 6 months to 7 years. It allows for a basis for estimating the risk of these elevated blood levels to a hypothetical child. It predicts likely changes in the risk of elevated lead concentration from exposure to variable concentrations of dust, soil, water, and airborne lead following some sort of action. So for example, if you're on a risk assessment team, you're looking at a contaminated environment and you're saying, what is this, if we're going to clean this up, what would be the safe level? You can put several variables into this model and identify what safe levels for cleanup or safer levels of cleanup might be. So it allows you to manage your cleanup efforts, sometimes extraordinarily expensive. The Bunker Hill site in northern Idaho is now approaching $1 billion of management costs over the past several decades. These are significant amounts of national treasure, if you will, and they require that we spend money to the best of our abilities in terms of mitigating risk, and we do these models to help in that decision-making process. We use this model to help designate or facilitate calculating these elevated blood load levels. It helps us express what and predict what might happen under different sorts of scenarios. It helps us focus our activities. Should we clean the water? Should we clean the soil? Should we mitigate yards, for example, to mitigate dust deposition that might have happened historically? All of these things help us before we turn a shovel on the ground, and it minimizes costs. What I've asked you to do here is I've given you a data set. Once you download this particular software, I'll have you go in and enter this data. And this is soil blood lead levels, maternal blood lead levels, some default values, and then you'll finally get a distribution graph. If you go through this model, you'll have what you need to come up with some of the data required for the risk assessment problem on the examination. At least you'll know the generalized approach. This is what the output should look like, and here I've penciled in the 10 microgram per deciliter standard. This is the distribution in probability of percent of the population. This is the age range of 12 to 24 month old children. And you can see that there is a significant percentage. In fact, it's 51% of the children are above this key action level in this particular model. And so that gives us some indication that that probably is unacceptable. And so we're going to have to mitigate that exposure via changing some of the variables that we put in, be by action on the ground in terms of environmental cleanup. There's another approach we have to modeling. This is switching over to ecotoxicology assessment. This is determining various exposures and endpoints in aquatic toxicity. This example that I'm going to use in the next few slides here just to conclude this lecture is acute toxicity testing, typically aquatic toxicity testing. In this particular case example, we're using daphnids. I actually have on the homepage of the course website Dance of the Daphnia video where we had a little bit of fun looking at these fairly small critters. Give you an idea of one of, this is a major sort of ecotox test, one of several that are used in freshwater organisms. They are documented in regulatory methodology, methods for measuring acute toxicity of effluents in receiving waters to freshwater and marine organisms. You can pull this up and search it on the internet and download to your heart's delight the hundreds of pages of standard methods associated with these acute toxicity tests. Various organisms are used, for example, Soria daphnia dubia, Daphnia pulix. Fathead minnows and rainbow trout are some of the fish. These are juvenile fish in early sensitivity. Acute toxicity tests, meaning that you're looking to kill animals. And so these water fleas, in a couple of these cases, or these juvenile fish, it's an LD50 experiment. There are other water tests associated with reproductive success, growth success, and then there's many other organisms that are used in various sort of tests like algae or earthworms for terrestrial analyses, for instance, toxicity of soil. In this particular test, what we do is take a look at dose response. We take a look at a dose, and this is for whole effluent toxicity testing, and so typically this is a management approach to an end of pipe. Where the pipe would contain perhaps mixed toxicants, and the question you ask is how toxic is this water in total, whole effluent toxicity, WET, to a particular type of animal, in this case daphnids. And so you might, for example, take as control water and then a 10% concentration, the rest being diluted dilution water, all the way up to 100% of the water. And the idea is looking for mortality. Typically, we do a probit analysis of the dose response to generate things like LD10s or LD50s. We can do these tests for 24 hours, 48 hours, 96 hours, depending upon what we want. Sometimes that's a static non-renewal. What does that mean? Static non-renewal means you take a 500 or 1 liter vessel, milliliter vessel, and place some number of daphnids in there, about 20 perhaps, and allow it to sit for 24 or 48 hours. There's no renewal of the water. There can be static renewal where the beaker is flushed and the solution is replaced periodically, and we can also have flow-through systems, and I'll show you one of those here in a moment. These flow-through systems actually have flowing concentration, so the idea is that the animal might be metabolizing the toxicant, but it's being continuously exposed to the normal natural concentration. The flow-through test apparatus looks like this. It's taller than I am. This was an apparatus that we used for daphnids flow-through test for some biodiesel analysis. Biodiesel being a good thing, and we were trying to demonstrate that, in fact, this biodiesel from rapeseed oil and canola oil, which is being used more and more in terms of vehicular fuels, has less toxicity, which in fact it did. It has about 1/10 of the aquatic toxicity that typical diesel fuels have in terms of the aquatic environment. This is a data set. Once you download the Probit program and have it up and open, this is a data set for you to go ahead and put in there. And here's again is some concentrations that you might find, 5, 10, 15, all the way up to 1,000. The number responding, and so the number exposed would be 20 daphnids in this particular case. You can look at the number responding in terms of the acute toxicity, acute lethality, and see that we're starting to approach 10, which would be the LD50, right? Some here between 50 and 100. So you can kind of speculate that your LD50 is going to be somewhere around 10. The Probit analysis software will allow you to actually come up with that exact number and the statistical significance of that number. The Probit analysis program that we have is used for calculating these lethal concentration, effective concentration values. I want you to download it from the course resources, the software link. It's typically best to load it to a flash drive, a diskette, a folder, something where it is. Create a folder for this. It's a peculiar program in that all of the results will actually be delivered back to that parent folder. So create a folder on your flash drive, on your computer. It's called Probit. That's where all your results will be. As it turns out, it's a text file. If you haven't worked with text files, you might need your notepad accessory to open up that file, practice it, play with it. It's something that you may or may not be able to open directly with Microsoft Word, depending upon how you've set your Word up. But typically, you can open it up with the notepad accessory that's available on all Windows operated systems. Well, what that does is that gives you a fairly substantial background, I would say, in terms of your exposure to storage and distribution of toxicants and how it relates. Hopefully, the case studies helped illustrate how this happens, the importance of storage and distribution in terms of toxicokinetics, and also in the whole syndrome of potential for intoxication. Next time, what we are going to do is try to develop some background for you on biotransformation elimination, the next step in this pathway, where we actually, our cells in our body actually do some biochemistry to transform and assist in the elimination of some of these toxicants. Until that time, we'll see you.